Yigmar Numa asks the question, Lam Nikrashman Anshe Knesset Gdola. Why is it that the Anshe Knesset HaGdola got that title? Anshe means men, Knesset means gathering, HaGdola. Apparently, they gained the title of the Great Assembly. What is it that they did that gained them that title, the Great Assembly? And says the Gemara, Sheikh Ziru Atar Yoshna, they returned the crown to its glory. Explains the Gemara, Asa Moshe, Moshe Rabbeinu came along and said, Akel HaGadol HaGibah VaNora. When Moshe Rabbeinu referred to Hashem, he used the accolades Akel HaGadol, the great God, HaGibah, mighty, VaNora, and awesome. That was the way that Moshe Rabbeinu referred to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Asa Yirmiyah came, VaAmar, Nachim Merakdim BeiChalo. Yirmiyah was around, right around the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and he said that the Gentiles are dancing in Hashem's sanctuary, Ayed Norosav, where is the awesomeness of Hashem? At that point, Lo Amah Nora, Yirmiyah stopped saying the word Nora. He only said, Akel HaGadol HaGibor. Also, Daniel, a little while later, Daniel came along and said, Nachrim Mishtabdim B'banav, the Gentiles are enslaving his children, Ayed Gvurosav, where is the might of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Lo Amah Gibor, he stopped saying Gibor. And that's how it stayed. And the titles Gibor and Nora were no longer used because Yirmiyah stopped it, using it. Daniel stopped using it. Asu Inu came along, these people, the Anshei Knesset Gdola, Va'amru Adarabba. They said quite the opposite. Zuhi Gvuroso. And you want to see the might, the awesome might of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Shekovish Yisro, he conquers his anger. Shenosin Erech Payim L'Rashayim. Hashem resists the anger that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should act with towards these wicked people. He allows them to be meraki. He allows them to dance in his sanctuary. Ve'iluhin Narosav. This is his awesomeness. Shemolim Mor HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if warned for the fear of Hashem, Eich Uma Achat Shechol Eskayim Ben Umos. How would it be possible that one nation could remain amongst all of the other nations? And therefore, that is his awesomeness. Therefore, they're called the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Why? Because they returned the crown to its glory, and they returned the titles of Norav and Gibor, awesome and mighty to Hashem. The Gemara ends with one question, V'rabbanan hechi avdi hachi. How is it possible that these great people, Yirmiyah and Daniel, changed from Moshe Rabbeinu? Moshe Rabbeinu used the titles Kel, HaGadol, HaGibor, VaNora. How did they eliminate it? And the answer is, Amar Rav Loza, Mitoch Sheyodim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shehamiti. Because they know that a God is emes, is stands for truth. Hashem uses the midah of truth. Therefore, lo kizvubo, therefore they didn't lie. They didn't want to lie, therefore they didn't say gibor v'nora. And that's the Gemara. The question that I'd like to ask on the Gemara, I think, is a bit obvious. And that is, we would be rather hard-pressed to call Yirmiyah HaNavi a kofer. We would be very hard-pressed to call Daniel a heretic. But if you think about this Gemara, what they seem to have engaged in was clear apikorsis. And I'll explain to you what I mean. We are well aware of the fact that when the Klal Yisrael sins, HaKadosh Baruch Hu pays us back in different ways. The Medrash Rabbah and Eicha Rabbah explains to us that when Nebuchadnezzar came, what he did was he destroyed ground flour. Don't think for a minute that Nebuchadnezzar had any power, any might. It was because the Klal Yisrael sinned and because they had destroyed everything that the Jewish nation was supposed to stand for. Therefore, Hashem decreed that the Beis HaMikdash was supposed to be destroyed. When Nebuchadnezzar came, he didn't destroy the edifice. It was already just nothing was left of it already. Effectively, Hashem allowed him to be the Makeh B'Patish, the one to knock down that which was already destroyed. But he ground flour, says the Gemara, meaning he doesn't have power. It's because the Klal Yisrael sinned that Hashem allowed that to happen. Now, that being said, what it means in plain language is the Gevura of Hashem is as equal now as it was then. Hashem didn't change. Hashem didn't become weak. Hashem didn't become less awesome. What happened was the Jewish nation sinned, and therefore there was a certain event that was supposed to transpire. Yet Yirmiyah is saying that apparently on some level the Gevura is lacking, Nora is lacking, and therefore he didn't want to say it because he was a man of emes. And that smacks of heresy. That sounds like a very difficult concept to understand. So I'd like to see this evening if we could address that and get a better understanding of this very concept. And to do that, I'd like to introduce a little bit of Greek mythology. Now, we're not big students of Greek mythology, but here's a little piece to sort of, if you have nothing to do one day and you want to discuss something, here's an interesting thing to discuss. Apollo was the god of the sun. He, being a mighty god, made an animal that was appropriate for such a mighty person. He made a lion. That was Apollo's creation, the lion, which roars and is mighty. Well, as it turns out, Apollo had a twin sister whose name was Diana. Apparently there was some sibling rivalry over there, and she got a little angry at Apollo, and she wanted to mock him. She wanted to scorn him. So what did she do? She made the cat. You see, not as big and mighty as a lion, not a roar, but a little meow. So to make fun of a brother, she made the cat. Okay, a little piece of Greek mythology to quote then the next time you want to sound like you know something. All right. Now, the reason why I find this very interesting is that if you study Greek mythology, you find examples of this kind of stuff over and over again. And would you like to know why? It's because of a very simple reason. Greek mythology involves the following concept. They take a man and give him godlike powers. Do you know how mighty this guy Atlas was? He could hold up the earth. You see, the whole concept is taking a man and giving him some superpower, some extraordinary strength or energy. He can throw things with great might. Mercury can run as fast as light travels because they took men and gave them superpower. And one of the great dangers when you begin a serious discussion of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a serious attempt to understand Hashem, is not to do exactly that which people have done, which is not to try to take a man and make him more powerful, more mighty, and call him God. And therefore, if a Jew wants to begin to understand Hashem and wants to begin a serious relationship with Hashem, you have to start from a very different perspective. And if a person wants to understand Hashem, they have to sort of what I call step out of the box. Step well out of every single concept that we normally engage in. Step away from our entire frame of reference. And let's try on some level to relate to Hashem as Chazal described by the Rebbe Baruch Hu. Hashem is all-knowing, all-present, and all-powerful. But if you think about those three concepts, all-knowing, meaning Hashem knows everything that happens on the planet as it happens. 6.5 billion people, 24,000 miles in circumference, everything that's happening simultaneously Hashem is constantly aware of. Hashem is all present. That means every single particle of physicality, the 13 billion light years of expanse known as the known universe, Hashem fills every part of it. And Hashem is all-powerful. Hashem can do anything that Hashem wants at any time, in any way. However, those three concepts really are extremely, extremely limiting. When you begin understanding Hashem, what you understand is that Hashem is limitless, boundless, limitless, and beyond any physical understanding or ability for a human to relate to. You see, Hashem is not just the place of all the world. Hashem is so beyond physicality that if you spend a lot of time thinking about it, you quickly realize that it's almost impossible for Hashem to be contained within physical existence, because for the super unbounded, for the super non-corporeal to actually physically manifest Kaviyachon himself is an absolute contradiction. Now, if you don't understand what I mean, don't worry about it, because you're in very good company. I also am not sure that I understand that. But if you read the Moreh Nevuchim, if you read the Rishonim's discussion of it, you'll see that it is a very difficult concept to relate to and understand Hashem. However, Hashem wants us to understand Him as much as we're able to. Hashem wants us to have a relationship with Hashem. And therefore, Hashem did a number of things to make it possible for a human to relate to Hashem. Hashem acts in different ways so that we can relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As a matter of fact, the names that we use in davening, the names that are used in the Torah, refer to different aspects of Hashem that Hashem limits Himself to so that we could relate to Hashem. The word Hamakom. The word Hamakom is actually not a name of Hashem, but is a kinoi, is a reference to Hashem, that Hashem is the place of all physicality. What that means is Hashem wears that trait. Hashem limits Himself. Hashem puts Himself into the world as the makom, as the place of everything, so that the human can relate to Hashem. Hashem also wears the trait of Adon HaKol. When we refer to Hashem as Ado, when we say that in various parts of davening, that means Adon HaKol. Hashem is the master of everything. The master of every act on the planet, the master of every leaf growing, the master of every single event that ever transpired. There's another expression that we use, Elokim. Elokim refers to Hashem as Baal HaKochos Kulam, that Hashem is not just the creator, not just the maintainer, the sustainer of every particle of physicality. Everything in existence is kept in existence constantly by Hashem, that Hashem is Tokif, Baal HaKochos Kulam. He is the sole source of energy throughout existence. Now, if you try to relate to Hashem as the source of existence, as a source of everything in existence at all times, you'll probably find it quite difficult. As if you would try to relate to an energy source that's endless, boundless, limitless, it's difficult to put your hands around it, it's difficult to feel. It's very easy to feel a fire. If you tell me an energy source causes a fire and that fire burns me, I can relate to that. However, the ultimate energy source is very difficult to relate to. And therefore, Chazal tell us that after Hashem sort of, if it could be limited himself to these names, these manifestations of Hashem, it still wasn't enough for the human to be able to actually relate to Hashem. And therefore, Hashem began acting with midos. Midos means that Hashem puts on, acts in a way of character traits. For instance, you'll read oftentimes in the Chumash, Hashem is charon af, Hashem is angry. It doesn't mean Hashem is angry. It means that Hashem acts with that midah. Hashem acts in that way so that we can relate to it. When I put my hand in the fire, it burns me. When I transgress various laws, Hashem acts with anger. All of a sudden, there's a give and a take. There's feedback. I can relate to Hashem. The sole reason that Hashem acts with midos, with character traits, is so that we can sense Hashem, and we can experience Hashem. We can feel Hashem's presence and relate to Hashem in a very direct way. All of the character traits that we find in ourselves, Hashem uses. Hashem acts as if it could be, Hashem is jealous. Hashem isn't jealous of anything. There's nothing that Hashem is competing with. But Hashem acts with that midah. Hashem acts with all the various midahs that you'll find in the human. The reason why Hashem does that is for us to relate to. Kindness, forgiveness, all of the midahs. If you'd like to know why it is that tikkun hamidahs, for us to correct our traits, is so significant to Avodas Hashem, it's because we're emulating Hashem in the way that we experience Hashem. Hashem acts with kindness, we act with kindness, the ultimate source of all perfection is Hashem. If Hashem acts with forgiveness and kindness, I try to emulate Hashem, I try to be like Hashem because Hashem is perfect. The source of all perfection is Hashem, I perfect myself by being like Hashem. Therefore, Tikkun HaMidos is central to everything that we do. Now, at the end of the day, a person is supposed to have a very powerful understanding of that. And there are three expressions that are used in our religion. Two are probably not correct. You ever hear the expression faith? You have to have faith. You have to have faith in Hashem. The way most people use that expression, I don't believe it's correct. You see, faith means if you give me a check, I have faith that it won't bounce. Do I know? I don't really know, but I have faith, I trust, I hope. Many times when you think about davening, when you think about knowing Hashem, we have faith. I don't really see Hashem. I don't really concretely understand that Hashem is present. I have faith. After all, the Torah says so, I believe. That is level one. Level two is yediyah, knowledge. Knowledge means I know concretely, positively, that something is true. For instance, if I were to take you to the top of the Empire State Building, hold you out over the ledge over there, you would look down 86 floors and you would know concretely that it would be very, very bad for you to fall. You may never have fallen in your life, not more than two or three stories, but you have a total yediyah gemura, total absolute knowledge that it's very, very bad for you to fall 86 stories, even though you've never experienced it. That's knowledge. That's knowing. But there's a third level. If you've ever spoken to someone who's actually fallen, you know it's very different. Your understanding is very different after you've experienced it. We all fear fire on some extent. If this room caught flame, we'd run right out. But it's very different if you ever burnt in a real fire and you really suffered burns, you experience it, You have a very different relationship with that understanding. You have a very different relationship to fire, and it's much more real. If you'd like to understand the ultimate level of relating to Hashem, it's not faith, it's not knowledge, it's experiential. You're supposed to experience Hashem's presence, and you're supposed to feel, not just know, but experience relating to Hashem fully, totally, and completely. And I believe that that's shot in Yirmiyah. You see, Yirmiyah was the Navi who prophesied about the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, and he was the man on the scene. And would you like to know what he experienced? He experienced no Gvura. Why? Because Hashem was acting Kaviyachal without that Midah. The Midah of Gvura was almost absent during that generation. To allow Gentiles to go into the Kodshei Kodshim and to dance is such a lack of Gibor, such a lack of might, that it's difficult to describe. And the reason why is because the Klal Yisrael sinned, and therefore Hashem started acting in a different manner. That Midah of Gvura Hashem sort of retracted, and was no longer acting in that manner, and therefore Yirmiyah could not experience it. The reason why he could no longer call Hashem Gibor was because Hashem was not manifesting himself Kaviyachal in that Midah. Moshe Rabbeinu felt it, Moshe Rabbeinu experienced it, Moshe Rabbeinu called Hashem Kel HaGadol HaGibor. But in the time of Yirmiyah already was not present, therefore it would have been a sheker. It would have been a lie for Yirmiyah to use that expression. Why? Because Hashem was not exhibiting that Midah. Daniel was a little bit longer down the path. He saw the Jews being enslaved, and he saw them suffering, and he said, where is the awesomeness of Hashem? If Hashem's chosen nation is being tortured, being enslaved, there's no awesomeness, and he was correct. Because at that stage, Hashem pulled back that Midah and was no longer acting with that Midah of Nora, of awesomeness, and therefore it would have been a sheker, it would have been a lie for Yirmiyah, for Daniel to refer to Hashem as Nora. Why? Because Hashem was not exhibiting it. You see, what the Nevi'im lived with was the experience of Hashem. When they davened the Shemona Esrei, it wasn't with faith, it wasn't with knowledge, it was literally experiencing Hashem, and Hashem wasn't acting with that Midah, Hashem wasn't exhibiting that trait, and therefore it would have been a lie to say it. And I believe that's exactly why Yirmiyah stopped saying it, and that's why Daniel stopped saying it. And if you're wondering, so how then did the Anshei Knesset HaGdola use that very expression, those very expressions that people greater than them couldn't experience? The Mashal explains to us that this is a timeline. You see, Yirmiyah was right at the point of the destruction of Beis HaMikdash. Daniel's main nevuah was later on, and the Anshei Knesset HaGdola were speaking at a time much later in that history. At the end of the exile was the time of Haman, the time of Ahasuerus. Then already the world was different. During the entire time of Ahasuerus, with Mordechai, Esther, Hashem showed very different midos. Hashem acted again with Gvura, Hashem acted as Nora, and therefore the Anshei Knesset HaGdola experienced it. They saw Hashem in the world in a different way. They returned the crown to its original glory. Why? Because they experienced the awesomeness of Hashem, they experienced the might of Hashem, they returned the crown because they began again using that term, because they again were able to feel it, because Hashem was acting with a different Midah. The main thing that I'd like to focus on from this is the concept of experiencing Hashem. And what that means is very, very different than faith, very different than knowledge, actually fully having a relationship in a very real way with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if you would like to begin that process, I have a little bit of advice for you. You have to really become a student of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have to be a student of Hashem. You have to be a student of yourself. Probably the easiest way to begin the process of experiencing Hashem is to pay attention to Hashkacha Pratis, to divine intervention. And I'd like to caution you before you begin this process. Most people, when they're looking for Hashkacha, are looking for big deal events. For the record, I believe Rabbi Kron is a fantastic speaker. However, when you listen to Rabbi Kron's stories, you'll hear these, wow, amazing stories. This happened, that happened, oh my God, and the whole world was saved. And the person's life, it changed. And such a big deal event. And it's great, it's inspiring, but I want you to hear well what I'm saying. Hashkacha Pratis, divine intervention, does not happen on the global big picture level. It doesn't happen in world-shaking events. It happens on the minutia. It happens in your life on very tiny, small details. not on life-changing events, not on big deal stuff, on very small, plain, day-to-day events. And if you begin looking for Hashem in the minutiae, in the details of your life, in the day-to-day events, you'll start seeing Hashem, you'll start experiencing Hashem in a very different way. And I'd like to share with you two examples of not big deal, Hashgacha Pratis, to show you what I mean. This past Pesach, my family and I, we were invited to go to a hotel. We've never done it before. For me, it was a good opportunity. There were 800 from people there. It was an opportunity to Mamet's Torah for my family's vacation. Whether I should or shouldn't have, bottom line is we did it. Okay. Now, I got up to speak the first time I was speaking. And to be honest, it was a little uncomfortable, large crowd. I'd never been there before. And I made a mental note as I walked in. The door behind me was open to this patio where kids were playing. And I made a mental note to make sure to close the door. I don't know if I mentioned this before, but I'm ADD. I'm highly distractible. So all I need is kids playing out there, and I'm gone. I would lose the whole schmooze. I wouldn't be able to focus. Anyway, I don't know, someone came over to me. I was about to begin, and I was going to start, when all of a sudden, a bird flew into the room. Well, a bird. Everybody starts looking at the bird. First of all, I became much more relaxed, because when you're trying to figure out how to get a bird out of the room, you're not so tense. But a very interesting thing happened. After a moment or two, the bird flew out the door. Someone said, quick, close the door. I quickly closed the door and then remembered that I had forgotten to close the door before. Baruch Hashem, the bird flew in. The door was closed. Shmooze went very well. I wasn't distracted. Not a big deal. Not life-changing. Not like, wow, let's write that down in the books. But that's Hashgacha. Divine intervention means Hashem is involved in my life in a concrete, real way, saying, Schaefer, Yingle, I don't want you to mess up. I don't want you to blow the schmooze. It's a good schmooze. I think the Olam could use it. We'll make sure the door gets closed. How do we get you to close the door? You're spaced out. We'll send a bird in. Hashem sends a bird. A bird comes in. Someone notices it. We send the bird out. Someone has the wisdom to say, close the door. Even I chafed, we close the door. Not earth-shattering. Not life-changing, but Hashem's involvement in my life. Let me share with you one more. Before Yontif, my wife says to me she'd like to go to town. It happens to be that the hotel was pretty far from town, but I said, fine, we're into town. She went to take care of something, and I was standing on the street, and I happen to be walking and pacing. I do that a lot. I'm pacing, thinking and learning, and all of a sudden, I noticed a shoe repair store. Now, don't ask me why I noticed it, and don't ask me why I also noticed that they happened to sell arches in that shoe repair store, but I stop in, and I see the very same arches that I put in my running shoes are on sale there. They're not that common, a bit unusual, and this is, I didn't expect them to be there. And I said, oh, that's interesting, and you know, how much are they? And she said, there's so much. I said, you know, let me buy a pair. Okay. And in fact, I bought myself a pair of these arches. And I also put them in my shoes. Now, the reason why I tell that to you is because my arches are a little bit sensitive. I was unaware of the following fact, but the hotel is huge. When I say huge, I can't describe how spread out it is. And we were given the one hotel room that's as far from the dining room as possible. As in, like, further than that, and further, and further, and the people they really don't like, and then they put us. I walked more miles on that Yom Tov than I can ever begin to describe, but it just so happens to be that my arches didn't bother me. Why? Because I had very specific, specialized running arches in my shoes, which I never thought to bring, but I happened to have just purchased Erev Yom Tov. Okay. But there's another little step here that I'd like to explain to you. Would you like to know why I need arches? I'll tell you why. I have an 8.5 wide foot. Nines don't really fit me too well, nor do eights, and 8.5 wides really don't come. So typically I buy a 9 shoe, and it's a little loose, so it's not offering me enough support. Therefore, I put the arches in to add support. Now, do you care about that? Do you care that I wear an 8.5 wide, the 9 is too big, the 8 is too small, 8.5 wide is not too common? I bet you're saying to yourself, why do I need to be coming to a shear to hear that? And you see, that's exactly the point, my friends. It's a minutia. But what if I tell you that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem, the creator of the heavens and the earth, cares enough about that and to make sure that I end up in a store, Erev Yom Tov, happens to be my eye gets caught by a particular arch, happens to be the woman is inviting enough to explain to me why I should purchase it, and I do buy that? That's called Hashgacha Pratis, that's Hashem's involvement, but it's not a big deal. As a matter of fact, it's such not a big deal that I should be embarrassed to say it. But what if I tell you that's the big yesod? that Hashem is involved in your life, not just in the big deal stuff, not just if you live and die, but in the day-to-day stuff, the stuff that you'd be embarrassed to tell people, stuff that's very, very small. But that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's the creator of the heavens and earth, who's with us all the time, every day, 24/7, intimately involved in our life. And when you begin studying Hashem's involvement in your life, you begin to get a very different experience. You see, when you wake up one day and you start counting, oh my goodness, this and this and this and this, you start becoming aware, Hashem is right there. Hashem is with me, and Hashem cares more than my friends, more than my parents even, more than my wife. Hashem loves me, is concerned for my good, and does things to arrange so that things should happen in the best way for me. When you begin experiencing that feeling, you begin experiencing Hashem, you connect the dots, you see Hashem, and you begin experiencing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's involvement in your life, and you begin relating to Hashem in a very different way. And I believe that that is one way for a person to experience Hashem. But I believe in our day, there's an even more, I would say, easier way for a person to experience Hashem. And that's with something that I think is very, very compelling. You may not know this, however, the blue whale is 100 tons of weight. 200,000 pounds. This is the largest mammal in existence. It is so massive and so powerful that literally it can sink ships. It's also, because it's a mammal, it's an air breather. It can hold its breath and submerge itself to 10,000 feet of depth, holding its breath for an hour easily. They've even counted up to 112 minutes. This mammoth animal is capable of discovering the most minute little shellfish buried in the ground, which sometimes it will eat, through echolocation. It sends out the little clicks. It receives back the vibrations, and it creates a pattern in its brain. It can tell where the fish is. But that echolocation, while it's so fine that it can detect tiny shellfish in the ground, is also so powerful that the whale will often use it to stun another fish. It'll yell an echolocation. The fish go, and the whale will eat it. It is a massive hunter, and it is a very, very impressive animal. You may wonder, where did the blue whale come from? Right? After all, we know everything evolved, right? You know, and I know, that everything began from nothing and just evolved. So it happens to be that this is a reasonable question which Darwin himself dealt with. Where did the blue whale come from? And Darwin, in The Origin of Species, not in the later version, but in one of the original versions, posited where, in fact, the blue whale came from. And practically, this is what he says. The bear, you know, like the grizzly or brown bear, would like and very much enjoy hunting various insects. And one day, the brown bear went into the water to hunt insects with its mouth open. I guess. And it began catching insects. And then a couple of mutations more, and you got the blue whale. Get it? Brown bear weighing about 1,200 pounds, air breather with claws, furry little guy, a couple more mutations, becomes 200,000 pound blue whale that's larger than school buses, that fills aquariums beyond description. Now, I hope that you begin to say to yourself, that's a little silly. But I want to share with you how it is that Darwin wrote this in a book, published it, and it was accepted in the world. And you see, nowadays, if anyone were to say that, they would be laughed out of the... It's comical. You can't even have a serious discussion about a bear evolving into a blue whale. But you see, science in the 1850s was extraordinarily primitive. The knowledge of the human body, the knowledge of biology, the knowledge of biochemistry was so primitive that I guess these things just happened. You know, it grew a little bit bigger and grew a little bit bigger, and then its mouth grew kind of big, and it got that blowhole on top, because after all, you know, it's inconvenient if your face is in the water all the time to breathe this way. So it, you know, kind of the blowhole just sort of like developed, and you got the closing on the blowhole when it goes down, and the opening and the echolocation. These, you know, just evolved. You see, the reason why Darwin was able to posit such ludicrous positions was because science was so basic. I said this before, and I believe it bears repeating. If Darwinism were invented today, it wouldn't get to first base. Because it's so ludicrous, once you have a thorough understanding of biology, of chemistry, if a modern person ever would have been exposed to this as a new concept, he would laugh it out of the sky. Why? Because it's so absurd. The reason Darwinism got accepted was because back then very little was known. It's possible these things could happen, who knows? But once you see the layers and layers of sophistication of things in existence, you quickly recognize that they're impossible. And I'd like to repeat one little piece and share with you exactly what I mean. As I mentioned before, computer programming is a very, very exact and demanding science. It used to be that programming was measured in hours, weeks, and sometimes in months. But it got to the point now where computer programs are measured in man years, meaning to say, how many years will it take us to write that program? If we take five men, put them in the room, how many years will it take to develop the code, the program there? And as a matter of fact, when Microsoft originally launched Explorer, it was month and month late because it took 90 man years to develop that program initially. There are now software programs measured in the hundreds, sometimes in the thousands of hours. They take teams of hundreds of people and assemble them for a given time because it's so many layers and layers because it's so complex, so demanding, so sophisticated. When they sent up the first space probe, someone did the math. How much coding went into the probe? Meaning to say, you have a lot of different functional parts of a space shuttle. There are many different things. They estimated that 22,000 man years of coding went into the space shuttle. Because there are so many different parts, so many different integrated pieces, that it would have taken 22,000 man years to code all of that stuff. Okay, and one more step. The amoeba, as you remember from basic science, is more sophisticated than any machine man has ever made. If you've ever seen an amoeba under a microscope, you'll understand that it is vastly more sophisticated than the space shuttle. Okay, now that being said, I'd like to share with you something interesting. As you know, the sperm cell and the egg cell are the beginning of man. That baby that comes out in a very sophisticated manner with many different components and many different organs. And one of the organs that the baby comes out with is a fully functional eye. The eye of the baby works with all its complexity and all of its intricacies and nuances. And it means in plain language is as follows. The eye is made up of a lens, a cornea, a pupil, a retina, an iris. And all the functional parts of it work in perfect harmony. Just leave a camera. Yeah. Let me explain to you what I mean in plain language. When you see something, that image is put onto your retina. The lens of the eye is able to fully focus, tighter, smaller, and to bring it into perfect vision. The retina decodes what it is, converts it into an electrical signal. Electrical signal goes along the optic nerve. It goes to a part of your brain, and inside your brain you see. Now, gentlemen, let me focus on one important part. If you were to cut open the brain of the human, what color is it? It's gray. It's not green, it's not red, it's not purple, it's not technicolor. When you see things, what's actually happening is it's a mirage. You see, the light hits your retina. The retina converts that into an electrical impulse. That electrical impulse sends a message to the visual cortex, the part of the brain that then translates that back into an imaginary color. You see inside your brain, you think you're viewing out there, you actually see inside your brain because it's converted into electrical signal that's reconverted back in your brain. Now let's study this for just a moment. One important observation. You have two eyes. One eye sees this image. The other eye is almost 2.5 inches away, sees a different image. And if you notice and close one eye, then the other, one eye and then the two images don't match. And as a matter of fact, if you've ever done, you know, when your kids, you've ever said cross-eyed, what you see is that if you have two images that don't match, you're effectively blind because it's all jumbled up. You see everything all confused. Why is it that you see with perfect acuity? You see one person when you look at one person, one tree. Why is it that you don't see two trees? And the answer really is quite simple. Those two images that you see are brought to the brain. The visual cortex blends them so that you have binocular vision. You see, one image doesn't enjoy depth. If you have two images and mold them together, then you could see things through a depth of vision and you appreciate it with a much different perspective. But who does the math inside the brain to mold those two images? But if you're not appreciating what I'm saying yet, there's another interesting phenomenon that you have to deal with. The image that hits the retina, if you remember from basic physics, is actually inverted. It's upside down, right? It's the opposite. Yet, I don't see the world standing on its head. I see the world straight. You see, what happens is, when it hits the retina, it's inverted. Then it's sent along the optic nerve, and the visual cortex, again, that part of the brain, recorrects it to be right side up. Okay, now this is very impressive until you start studying the biochemistry behind it. You see, here's some of the biochemistry. You ever hear the expression, in the blink of an eye? You know, in a blink of an eye. You know that a blink of an eye is very, 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 very slow? Because when they measure the biochemistry of the eye, blinks of an eye are phenomenally long. I used to think a nanosecond was quick. A nanosecond is 1/1,000,000,000th of a second. A nanosecond is not how they measure biological processes. They're measured in femtoseconds. A femtosecond is 1/1,000,000th of a nanosecond, meaning 1/1,000,000,000th of a billionth of a second. Let me explain to you what happens. Your retina is comprised of approximately 137 million cells. 130 of those are basically receptor sites for black and white. 7 million of those are receptor sites for color. Those various cells receive the color and become transducting agents. That means they transduce the photons into the beginning process of electrical impulses. If you don't understand it, you're in good company, because I surely don't understand it. But when you read how complex the system is, what happens is a chemical change happens in femtoseconds, meaning to say the photon hits the back of the retina, and in a heartbeat of a heartbeat, in a flash of a heartbeat, less than a nanosecond, it creates a chemical change that begins the process. Now, if you understood sight properly, you would have the following question. It happens so quick that you should be effectively blind. Why? When you hold up a piece of paper to read, and you see the letters, it hits the retina, the signal is sent, but then it's gone. You see, it happened in a femtosecond, in a millionth of a billionth of a second, the image is read by your brain, and then it's gone. Why do you keep seeing? Because your eye wavers ever so little, ever so slightly, so that you're constantly seeing. When you think you're looking at something straight on and you're constantly holding focus, what's actually happening is your eye is wavering and you're constantly getting different images to the back of your brain. And what's actually happening is your retina is constantly getting impulses. What's happening along the retina, optic nerve, and the neurocenter is you're getting approximately 1.5 million stimuli per 1/1,000,000th of a second, with such speed, with such rapidity, that you don't even realize how you're able to watch moving objects and see them smoothly. But don't worry about that, because at the same time that your retina is receiving and sending, transducing at the billionth, hundredth billionth of a second, thousand billionth of a second, the optic nerve is bringing it along that way, and the visual cortex is converting it at that speed, and all of this is happening. And they say that if you had 100 of the most powerful supercomputers in the world working on it, they could not begin to emulate sight, because it's beyond human comprehension. And I want you to think about the following idea. All of that came from two cells, the sperm cell and the egg cell. But that's not the wonder of creation. If you'd like to understand the wonder of creation, it's where does that coding come from? You see, all of the coding for the entire human body comes from the DNA. The DNA is a submicroscopic, if you've seen it under 100,000 power microscope, you can't even see the shadow. All of the coding for the entire human being is within the DNA, which is a submicroscopic part of one cell. Every single cell in your body has it. All of the coding for all the wisdom to create the 100 billion neurons of your brain, the eye, the muscles, the skin, everything is contained within this submicroscopic part called the DNA. And when you see that, you experience the wonders of Hashem's creation. You see, in 1850, Darwin could posit that a bear could convert itself into a blue whale because they didn't know this stuff. But we have an advantage in our day that people of olden days didn't. And there's such wonders of Hashem's world that are exposed in every science textbook. You open a New York Times on Tuesday and you see the science section, and you see level after level of depth that man previously couldn't begin to imagine. You get to experience Hashem in a way that people of previous generations never could. We have an advantage living in our time, and that is we could experience Hashem in a way that people of previous generations could not begin to. You've heard it many, many times, the olden days, and it's true. Many years ago, people were much more steeped in learning. Many years ago, they were insulated within a Jewish community. Many years ago, there were many advantages. My friends, I'm telling you, we have an advantage in our generation never before in the course of history. And that is we could see the wonders of Hashem's world right there. You could experience Hashem by opening a biology textbook and see things that are so mind-numbing that it's beyond comprehension. And when you do that, you have the opportunity to experience Hashem in a way that previous generations didn't. See, the Anshei Knesset Gedolah were not greater than Yirmiyah. They were not greater than Daniel. As a matter of fact, quite the opposite. But they were able to experience Hashem in a way that the Nevi'im couldn't. Why? Because Hashem manifested Himself, Kaviyahu, more in that generation. And for us living in our times, the availability of scientific knowledge, the availability of these concepts is very, very simple. I'd like to share with you an Eitzah. I think it is a very, very wise idea for you to read to your children. Obviously, read to your children because hopefully you'll create a relationship, you'll teach them something, but I recommend that you especially read science textbooks to your children. And here's the great secret. The great secret is not for your kids, for you. You see, when you read science textbooks written for children, they want to show you the wonder of the world. And it's done with such honesty, and it's done with such simplicity, that when you read science textbooks that are geared for children, you say, this is astounding. How could it be? And you see, when you get all caught up in the minutiae, you start studying the 8 steps of the transduction theory of how it is that the photons get converted into electricity, you get so numbed out that you lose the wonder of it. But when you read about the eye on a very simple level, when you read about the pancreas on a very basic level, especially when it's presented with tremendous innocence to children, you say, this is astounding. This is unbelievable. And you experience Hashem. Ultimately, our religion is not about faith, not even about knowing Hashem, it's about experiencing Hashem. But to experience Hashem, you have to work on it. The primary system is to relate to Hashem in a very real way in my life, and that's to study the Hashgacha, to study Hashem's involvement, to study the divine intervention, to see Hashem there with me, to write down those strange events that seem to keep happening, and after a while you begin to get a clearer picture, and you experience Hashem. Another way is to just study the wonders of creation that are more accessible in our day than ever before, and you get a very different sense. And what Yirmiyah and what Daniel were doing were being very candid and very honest. Moshe Rabbeinu was able to experience Hashem, Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, Hanora. Yirmiyah said, that's not the me that Hashem is showing now. Hashem acts with different character traits at different times. The only reason Hashem limits Himself, Kaviyachol, the same way Hashem limits Himself to names, Hashem limits Himself to act with midos so that we could relate to Hashem. But at the time of Yirmiyah, Hashem was not showing the midah, the trait of Gibor, therefore Yirmiyah stopped saying it. In the time of Daniel, Hashem was not showing the trait of Nora, of awesomeness, therefore he stopped saying it. Anshei Knesset Gedolah came at a different time, they were able to experience it. Understanding that that's what it's about. It's not about knowing Hashem, it's about experiencing Hashem, is a tremendous understanding. The Anshei Knesset Gedolah were gifted. They lived in a different time. And because they lived in a different time, they were able to experience Hashem in a way that is greater people than they couldn't. And my friends, I say, in our world, it's especially true. You know, when you suffer, sometimes it's hard to see Hashem. if your experience was shaped by the years 1939 to 1945, while you were very aware that Hashem was there, because Hashem was saving you, it was a very austere, very bleak existence, and it was very difficult to experience Hashem. But when you live a life of freedom, when you live a life with such opportunity, when you live a life where you're granted everything and right there, it's much easier to experience the goodness of Hashem, the kindness of Hashem, the loving nature of Hashem. But you have to train yourself to see it. You have to train yourself to study the Hashgacha. You have to train yourself to be fully aware and into it. And at the same time, you also have to train yourself to experience Hashem on the level of scientific knowledge, level of understanding, and level of seeing things and relating to Hashem in a very different way. There's a tremendous lesson to learn from Yirmiyah and from Daniel. And I think it's a lesson for us in terms of relating to Hashem in a very positive way. I want to close with one last observation. And that is the very starting point of the Gemara. The Gemara's question was, why are they called Anshei Knesset Hagdola? What was their great accomplishment? What is it that they brought forth to the world that they got this title, the Great Assembly? Now, gentlemen, I want you to understand, Anshei Knesset Hagdola did many, many things. They made many, many takanas. They wrote Shemoneh Esrei. They changed the face of Judaism. Despite all of their vast accomplishments, 120 great men, many of whom were Nevi'im, despite everything they did, the Gemara's question was, why were they called the Great Assembly? And says the Gemara, the answer is because this single event. But if you think about it, what did they really do? They experienced Hashem in a way that Hashem was available. Yirmiyah would have experienced that as well. Daniel would have experienced it, but Hashem didn't make himself accessible that way. But the answer is, they were the men on the scene, they experienced Hashem, and the result was that single event made them the Anshei Knesset Hagdola because they returned the crown to its glory. If a person can live in our generation and actually experience Hashem, can really feel Hashgacha Pratis, and can really live it, and transmit that understanding to his children, to his family, to others around him, he is accomplishing a tremendous, tremendous event. It could well be that it'll take you years and years of learning, years and years of growth so that you could experience it. And it could be your one crowning achievement is that one time when you fully, fully get it. You fully, fully feel Hashem is present. Hashem is involved. Hashem is right there in my life. That single experience, that could be that one Shemoneh Esrei when you really feel Hashem, that's your crowning achievement of existence. That might well be the reason you're put on the planet. And it is very important to appreciate what a person could do by understanding, by relating, and by experiencing. May Hashem grant us the wisdom, understanding, and ability to put this into practice.